Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Yeah, that's it. That's what we're doing. We're doing another one from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. This is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today we're going to talk a little bit about why true believers are actually the most reachable demographic. I might zhuzh that title. Not sure if I'm fully settled on it yet, but that's sort of what I'm setting out to explain in this episode of the show. What do I mean by that? Why true believers are actually the most reachable demographic? I mean, when it comes to, you know, kind of ideological warfare, when it comes to trying to get people who are on an opposing ideology or dug into an opposing ideology to see things from your perspective or to become enlightened and join your side, it's actually the true believers that are the most reachable. And that seems kind of counterintuitive right off the bat, right? As a title, it's like, absolutely not. There are so many other people that should be and would be naturally more reachable. I recently did a rewatch of season one of Andor. I don't know if you've ever seen this show. We're talking about it this week on the other podcast that I do, The Oneer, with Austin and Kramer. That's another show that you can watch over on YouTube. If you're not subscribed to The Oneer, what are you doing? If listening to me talk about the fall of modern civilization as we know it is all too much, you can pop over to The Oneer and just listen to me talk about movies and occasionally TV shows. That's all we do at The Oneer. We just talk about movies. It's a lot easier of a ride there. And this week we are talking about season one of Andor because season two just premiered. So we decided we would do a revisit of season one. In my opinion, obviously, I'm going to give a much more thorough breakdown of season one of Andor and the plot and everything that happens in that show over on that episode of the Oneer podcast. That's not what I'm doing today on People Pleaser, but I will just say that in my opinion, in my subjective opinion, Andor is undoubtedly the best thing ever made in the entire Star Wars cinematic universe. That includes Empire Strikes Back. That includes A New Hope. There are nerds everywhere who are rage quitting the internet right now listening to this, who just threw their laptop against a wall. This guy's an idiot. He has no idea what he's talking about. I actually think that the reason why Star Wars faithful who were raised on the show, who refuse to accept that Andor is the best thing that's ever been made in the Star Wars cinematic universe, I actually think the reason why they think that is because Andor's too good. It's so good that it makes everything else look worse by comparison, and that makes the Star Wars faithful angry. They're like, I don't like that this stupid Disney Plus TV show has the power to make Empire Strikes Back look kind of silly and bad. Like, fuck that. How dare you do that to my favorite thing? And I think to them, it feels like a betrayal of the IP and a betrayal of like the property of Star Wars to make something that is so good that it almost feels like it couldn't exist in the same cinematic universe. I think the opposite. I think that it's honoring Star Wars. I actually think that all of these other shows that play to like little kids, that just kind of these like adventure, like popcorn, sit down and turn your brain off and watch people shoot blasters and play with lightsabers stuff. I actually think that stuff dishonors what made Star Wars great in the first place. What made Star Wars kind of a cultural phenomenon. Yes, it's always been fun and plucky and had really fun, cool, interesting characters and banging all-time great soundtrack and groundbreaking special effects, but it was a sociopolitical commentary on the Vietnam War. Like, it was a commentary on, like, you know, this ragtag militia rebellion fighting against this all-powerful, heavily funded, incredibly overwhelmingly powerful imperial force. And yeah, he was obviously doing allusions to Nazi Germany with the military uniforms and the shape of the helmets and all of these different things. But he was also talking about, you know, how America became its own empire and started invading other sovereign nations and Trojan horsing in all of these astute sociopolitical commentaries of the time into this kind of popcorn fun space adventure movie. And I think a lot of that slowly has gotten baked out of the Star Wars property, and it's just become about pew, pew, look at the laser guns and the lightsaber tricks and backflips and stuff. And some of that is by George Lucas's own hand, that over time, as he got more and more enamored with the idea of what special effects could do, he was just like, but look, I can make a Jedi jump really high and do lots of flips. And that's fun. And then the show just became like, how many times can the Jedi do, can flip his lightsaber? That was until we got the movie Rogue One. Turns out it's the best movie in the Star Wars cinematic universe. It just is. I remember the first time I saw it, I was sitting in the theater, and maybe 20 minutes into the movie, I was like, oh, well, this is the best thing they've ever made. Just, it's never looked this good from a cinematography standpoint. That's the Greg Fraser effect. You get Greg Fraser shooting sci-fi, and it just looks incredible. Greg Fraser, if you don't know, shot both of the Dune movies. He shot the Batman. Greg Fraser is like the guy. Used to be Roger Deakins. It's still Roger Deakins. Roger Deakins is still the GOAT, but Greg Fraser is like the new guy who's just like, oh yeah, if you get Greg Fraser to shoot something, it's game over. Rogue One was the first time that I saw the franchise grow up with me. It was like, oh, this is the first time since in my life as an adult that it feels like the franchise is continuing to talk to me on an adult level. And what's interesting is if I go back to those original ones, there's stuff in there for adults too. It just feels like at some point, it all became, because the justification that a lot of Star Wars fans will give you is like, it's always been for kids. It's a kids show. It's for kids. And it's like, I think yes and no. Andor comes along and it blows all of this stuff out of the water. It's a complete game changer to the point where it's like, this is no longer just a good piece of writing for the Star Wars universe. This is just good writing, period. This is just good prestige television. This should be a show on HBO. This should be winning all of the awards in television. It didn't, but it should have been. This should be winning all the Emmys. This should be winning all the Golden Globes. In my opinion, Andor is not only the best thing ever put to the Star Wars cinematic universe, it's genuinely one of my favorite TV shows I've ever watched, at least the first season. We're only 3 episodes into the second season, so I don't know how the show is going to progress, but the first season is like some of the best writing and acting, production design, structure I've ever seen in a TV show ever. Andor is about the actual emotional cost of participating in a rebellion against an all-powerful totalitarian regime. So obviously, for anyone paying attention to this podcast and to the state of our world currently, it is an incredibly, bitingly, hauntingly relevant show. Every single episode has lines and dialogue that are just so pungent to the current moment and to our current state of affairs. It's so obvious that Tony Gilroy and Bo Willimon, who are, you know, two of the main writers on this show, are talking about our current state of affairs, but are also talking about something that Star Wars has always been about. Star Wars, part of the charm of Star Wars is it's always been about how does this ragtag militia of rebels fight against this all-powerful, you know, overwhelmingly, I mean, the first thing we ever really see the Empire do in A New Hope is unveil a new weapon that blows planets up, that shoots a laser that annihilates planets. They take, like, this is the thing, is when people are like, it's a kid's show, it's for kids. In the very first movie, they take Carrie Fisher and they say, we're gonna stand you in front of this window and have you watch as your home planet, where everyone you've ever known, all of your friends and family are currently living, and we're going to blow your home planet up in front of you. The entire planet. Not your house, not your neighborhood, not your city, the entire planet. Every aspect of your lineage, of like who you are as a person, is going to be decimated and disintegrated in front of you. And that not only shows the power of the Empire, but the cruelty of the Empire. And that's what Rogue One, and that's what, to a greater extent, Andor is all about. It's about what it costs for people to actually, you know, invest their entire life into resisting something as big and as powerful as an intergalactic empire. And I just think this is really, really prescient storytelling for anyone who's curious about how to resist something like a totalitarian regime. But today I want to talk specifically in Andor about Cyril Karn. Cyril Karn is one of our main villains in the Andor series, and a great script is probably a script that has a great villain. And while Emperor Palpatine and Darth Vader are great classic movie villains because of their overwhelming presence, the screen presence of, and the magnitude of their power and the presence of these characters and the iconography of their look and their characteristics. Cyril Karn's a great villain because he's such a human character. He's such a puzzling character. The puzzle of Cyril Karn as a character, the main question of Cyril Karn for people who watch the show Andor is, why does this guy love the Empire? What is going on here? Why does Cyril Karn have such a raging boner for the Empire? He has no reason to. Cyril Karn's not a Sith in training. He's not like being seduced by the dark side of the Force. He's not, you know, pulled in by the promise of great power. What is it about the Empire that has Cyril Karn willing to give anything and everything for it? And it's so kind of puzzling and enraging because Cyril Karn, for all intents and purposes, is a low-level nobody. He's a guy who he has a complicated, that's to put it lightly, relationship with his mom, who's pretty abusive and cruel to him. He doesn't have a father figure present, and it seems like his whole life is spent trying to avoid his mom and also trying to shut his mom up by achieving a level of success that she can't deny, because she's always kind of putting him down and, you know, saying that he's never going to amount to anything. And one way that he tries to do this when we first meet him is he joins this corporate police force that's in charge of just sort of doing minor police work around different districts that the Empire, that are inside of the Empire's jurisdiction. But he's not like an Imperial officer. He doesn't go through Imperial officer training. He's like, he's kind of like a rent-a-cop. Like, you know, when you're driving on the freeway and you see a white car behind you that has the lights on top and you go, oh shit, it's a cop. And then the car pulls up on the side of you and it just says like CFC security or something like that. I don't know. And you're like, oh no, that's not a real cop. That's just like some guy who dresses up like a cop, but is hired by a private corporation to do security for like their parking lot or something. That's who Cyril Karn is. He works for just some corporate security task force, but he takes his job really seriously to the point where like the show's constantly making fun of him. He does things like he tailors his uniform to look more official and look more cool. Like Cyril's such a loser and such a weirdo from the jump. It's like, why does this guy give a shit so much about being the best rent-a-cop he can be? If he cares so much, why doesn't he just go into, you know, some sort of Imperial officer training? Why doesn't he become a stormtrooper? Why doesn't he, you know, try to do something with a little more, you know, risk to it, with a little more skin in the game? Maybe it's just because he's not important enough in the grand scheme of the galaxy to even qualify for such a program. But nonetheless, Cyril Karn really, really devotes himself to his work. And what's weird is, like, in the first three episodes of Andor, Cyril Karn fucks up in a way that loses him his job. He gets fired, and he's basically told by the upper-ups, like, you're lucky we're just firing you. You're lucky we're not, like, sending you to a work camp or killing you. And again and again and again, the Empire just sort of fucks Cyril Karn over. There's just so many different ways where being such a sycophant and such a cuck for the Empire doesn't work out for Cyril. Like, again and again, it's like, what are you getting out of this, dude? This is not going well for you. Why can't you see that there's nothing here for you, that these people don't respect you, they don't like you, that the organization you're working for is like obviously evil? Why the fuck do you care? And he becomes this kind of enigma in the show. I think the reason why Cyril is such a great character, and it's another reason why Andor is one of my favorite TV shows of all time, is because of how accurately it reflects the world as I see it, the world as I'm currently experiencing it, because I'm constantly looking at working class people in my own country and thinking the exact same question. Why do you love the regime so much? Why do you love the Trump regime? What are you getting out of it? What are they doing for you? The regime only lies to you. They exclusively lie to you. Every time they promise you that they're going to give you something and make your life better in some way, it always results in them making your life materially worse. And then they tell you, hey, we just made things better, and you just eat it up. I mean, recently, Trump posted on Truth Social, price of gas is down, price of eggs are down, everyone's happy, everything's going great. And it's like, no, actually, the average price of gas is up and the average price of eggs are up. He's just lying. But it doesn't matter to the Trump faithful. They're just like, if he gets on the internet and says prices are down, that then prices are down. It what he says is what's true. We're surrounded by Cyril Karns, right? People who, why are you so bought into this thing? It seems like it's actively bad for you. Like, it loses you friends. You have people in your life who don't want to be associated with you anymore because of this, and you continue to cling to it, and it's so kind of head-scratchingly baffling and maddening. There are several reasons why people, as I see it, why people are sold out on the Trump regime and why people might sell out on the Empire in the Star Wars universe. The higher ups, officers, people who actually wear the gray Imperial uniform with like the little, you know, the little buttons on it, like the blue buttons and the red buttons, and you know, people like the military officers that everyone's British for some reason in the Empire. Like, if you're going to be an officer, you have to be British. I don't know. There's probably some kind of xenophobic, racist reason for that. But those people, when it comes to what their motivations are, they could have the motivation of power, of seeing the absolute power that exists at the upper echelons of the Empire, and they're just drawn in by the allure of that power, the idea that maybe someday I could get that level of power. Maybe some of those people have even been exposed to the power of Darth Vader and Emperor Palpatine, and they actually see the real level of power that exists in the upper ranks of the Empire. And then at that level, you know, there's two different things that could be going on that keep people sycophantic, that keep people in line, that keep people, you know, doing what they need to do. One is this sort of kind of soulless desire to be a part of that power, to be touched by that power, to be able to have some morsel of that power, a fraction of that power, that wealth, that control, that if I'm up there, I'm protected. And that's the other thing, the protection thing, because the other aspect is once you're at that upper level, you're afraid, right? Because if you can actually see someone get choked out by Lord Vader and go, oh, there are people who have space magic? Because that's the thing about Andor that I love, is like, it really shows that most of the people in the galaxy don't even seem to have an idea of what the Force even is. They don't know that there are space wizards going around shooting lightning out of their hands and force choking people to death. All they know is like money and figures and politics and policies and the Senate and elections. That's what they know. They don't know the actual levels of power at the top. They're not exposed to it. They've never had a meeting with, they've never met Emperor Palpatine face to face. They don't even know what the guy looks like. But there are a few people in those upper echelons who have been in meetings where Lord Vader has choked someone out who talked back to him, and they've gone, oh shit, this guy has telekinetic mind powers and he can choke people to death with his mind. I'm in trouble. The fact that I'm at the level where I can be in a meeting with him where I could get choked out means I'm very vulnerable and exposed, and I'm probably too powerful to just like get out. I'm too powerful to just get out and get into a different line of work. And we see this right at in our real world, right? We see people who are in the upper echelons where it's like, do none of these people have a spine? All of these people, you know, Lindsey Graham, who said terrible things about Donald Trump when he was campaigning against him and then became just a total Donald Trump simp. Ted Cruz, who Donald Trump like insulted him again and again and again when they were campaigning against each other. I think he insulted his wife, and then Ted Cruz becomes a Donald Trump simp. You know, J.D. Vance, who just again and again was like, Donald Trump's the worst thing that could ever happen to America. He's America's Hitler. And now J.D. Vance is where he is, killing popes and fucking couches. And you think, how do these people at the upper levels not grow a spine or do something about this? They're the ones who are in a position to do something about it. Well, either they are, you know, sort of drawn in by the allure of the actual power that is held by the executive branch and their proximity to it, that they think, ooh, I'm so close to the top. And there's sort of a sniveling soullessness to it where they just desire a fraction of that power and they feel like they are protected by that power. Or it's the other thing, which is they realize the corruption of the level of power they're in and they're terrified and paralyzed with fear to do anything about it. Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican from Alaska, recently said, We are all afraid. She said this about her Republican colleagues. She said, it's quite a statement, but we are in a time and place where I certainly have not been before. And I'll tell you, I'm oftentimes very anxious myself about using my voice because retaliation is real, and that's not right. And I think that, obviously to just say that took a lot of courage from this senator. I think a lot of her colleagues would probably call her a liar and say, like, nah, she's talking out of her ass. That's not true. We're not afraid. I'm not afraid. And maybe, like, the soulless power grabbers aren't afraid. They're just there because they want the power and they don't actually care about anything. But I think that she probably is talking to several of her friends and colleagues who are maybe more traditional conservatives who got in because they believed in conservative politics and the conservative ideology. They actually thought it was, like, the more rational way to govern. And now that they're at the upper levels and seeing what's being done in their name, they're being kind of stricken with this real fear of, like, oh no, I'm in too deep and I'm genuinely afraid to do anything about it. I don't know how to resist this. I'm too high up to just, like, abandon it and get into a different line of work. I can't just switch parties and go be a Democrat. They probably wouldn't have me. I couldn't get elected over there. What else am I going to do? What other line of work am I going to get into? It becomes kind of a sunk cost fallacy, but even these people who have a conscience at this level are too afraid to do anything about it. And at this point, it's just self-preservation and trying to sort of maneuver in a way where, like, you're trying to not to get noticed. And this, I think this exists with Democrats and Republicans alike. And this is what you see in the Mon Mothma storyline of Andor, is a person who has achieved a level of prowess and visibility in politics. She's a senator who's very visible, and she's known as being a senator who isn't afraid to push back against the Empire, but nobody knows the true levels of her disdain for the Empire and the true levels of her commitment to the rebellion. Nobody can know because she's terrified. They'll kill me if they know. They'll take my family out if they know. So she's got to sort of operate in the shadows as a person who is willing to, kind of like Senator Murkowski here, she's willing to publicly make statements that talk about the danger of the regime, but she's not willing to go full blast and just do what's necessary to dismantle the regime because she's terrified. But, like, Cyril Karn is not those people, right? Cyril Karn is sort of a working class schlub. So he's not an upper level who could reasonably think that he might be able to. I think there is a little bit of, like, power hungry ladder climbingness, but I don't think that's actually who Cyril Karn is. I don't think he's just trying to climb the ladder for status and money. I don't think that's who he is. The other people who sort of buy into the Empire or the totalitarian Trump regime are kind of lower class people who, for lack of a better term, I'm just going to call, like, morons, right? Dumbasses, ignoramuses. We've just got people who just love Trump because they're fucking stupid. I talked about this in my episode of the podcast, Vibes Over Substance. There are just so many people who, you know, like Jake and Logan Paul and like Joe Rogan and like Elon Musk because they're just kind of dumb. And they're just like, these guys have money and I like money. And it's literally Dax Shepard from Idiocracy going, I like money. And it's like that. I like muscles. I like muscles and vibes and money. And there are those people in the Empire, right? There are people who are just like, I like when big spaceship is big. When the big spaceship comes in and it's big, I think that's cool. Empire got bigger guns. I think stormtroopers are cool. Look at the uniforms. They look cool, dude. Have you ever seen a TIE fighter versus just, like, some shitty speeder that are rebels driving? I'd rather be in a TIE fighter. That's cooler. We've got just, like, idiots, right, who just like Donald Trump because they're like, I like that he's a guy, and I like that he sometimes says funny stuff, and Shane Gillis do a funny impression of him. And I like it when Shane Gillis do a funny impression of him. And I think I'm going to vote for him because of that. I saw a video just today where they were interviewing a kid on a college campus about why he voted for Donald Trump. And he was like, he passed the vibe check over Kamala.
And who'd you vote for?
Trump.
Trump.
For me, I think he passed the vibe check compared to, like, Kamala Harris. Like,
of course, it's Kamala. Can't ever get the name pronunciation right because these people are dipshits, right? They're morons. And I'm sorry I can't be delicate about it, but that's what it is.
A little bit.
He raped a woman.
The what?
Donald Trump raped a woman.
raped the woman?
Donald Trump, he raped the woman.
Oh.
Was that the vibe check?
Who is Cyril Karn, right? Because he's not a dipshit. Cyril Karn is capable and smart and conniving and like capable of putting together plans. Even though Cyril Karn fucks up his mission in the first three episodes of Andor, he's entrepreneurial and enterprising. He goes around the back of his superiors and he's willing to track down this murderer. And that's what, you know, that's because who Cyril Karn is a true believer. That's who he is. He believes somehow in the cause of the Empire. Somehow it has been sold to Cyril Karn that and indoctrinated into him that what the Empire is doing is in everyone's best interest, including his, even when they do things that look sometimes bad. That what the Empire is doing is introducing order and stability to the galaxy and safety. And he really, truly, genuinely, in his soul, believes in it. And he's sold out on that belief. He's risked for that belief. The thing about belief is, it does require risk, right? Belief requires us to risk. And we believe in all different kinds of things. We all have to believe in things, right? Like, in order to keep going, we have to believe in things. There's no reason to keep going if there's no belief left. Even if things seem really, really bleak, on some level, even right now in our current circumstances, we believe that we can turn the tide. Some part of us, even if it's very, very small, believes that we might be able to save the planet from an extinction level climate disaster. I think there's some part of us that believes that we are going to be able to slow down this totalitarian regime that has taken over the United States right now, and that we're going to be able to maybe win future elections and push this back in a progressive direction. We have to believe that in order to keep fighting, in order to keep moving forward one day at a time. And there's other things that we choose to believe in, right? Falling in love is a choice to believe in something, right? Like, you meet somebody, you date, you make sort of determinations based on what green flags they're showing you, what red flags they're showing you. You have sort of a checklist of like things that you know to avoid from past relationships. What is this person offering you at this point in your life? Does it match up with your goals? All of these different things. And at some point, you kind of need to make a choice. Am I going to take the plunge and go in deeper with this person? Or am I going to cut this off and move on and go back into the dating pool and, you know, choose to believe in that? And there's a choice of belief in there, right? Like, you're making a choice of, I believe that I have a better chance going back into the dating pool, and I have a better chance of finding someone who can be better for me and my happiness and my goals out there in the dating pool than this person. And that's the belief I'm choosing to put my stock in. Or you choose, I think I can make it work with this person. I think this person is going to give me a really solid chance at happiness and achieving, you know, kind of the life that I'm looking for. But it's just a belief, right? You're choosing to believe in something and you're risking. There's immense risk in that. We do it with jobs all the time too. We'll be on a job search and we'll get kind of paired up with a company. And in order to be successful at a certain company, sometimes you have to make a choice to like believe in the cause of that company. I remember when I was working in the service industry, I was always so surprised when I would meet people at different restaurants that I worked at who seemed to really believe in the cause of like that restaurant's bottom line and that restaurant's goals. There would be managers and sometimes even fellow servers who seem to really take seriously the policies and the daily goals of what we want our daily sales to be and stuff like that. And they would be like really bought in on kind of the corporate mentality that is put out in that company. And I never understood it, because every kind of survival job I've ever had in the service industry or in retail has been just sort of a side job to my actual goals and passion, to the thing I actually believe in, which is creating art and telling stories and, you know, being a creative person. That's what I've always cared about, is making music, making movies, making, you know, theater, dance, whatever it is. That's always been my passion. And all of these other things were just sort of things that I was forced to do to get by in a capitalistic paradigm, to pay my rent, to pay my bills, but I could never be convinced to be a true believer in these companies. And I'd be working with people who seemed to be able to convince themselves themselves to be a true believer in the cause of that company. And it honestly wasn't until the very last restaurant I ever worked for that I decided to start kind of tricking myself to believing in it. Because what I saw was the people who were able to trick themselves into believing in it did better than me. They would get better tips, and like they just seemed to enjoy work more than I did. Work was like a prison for me. It was like torture. And when I finally, it just clicked one day where I was like, what if I just decided to give a shit? What if I just decided to focus on being better at being a server? I flipped a switch one day and I decided I'm just going to start going to work, showing up early, always making sure that like my uniform is washed and pressed and looks good. And I'm going to show up and like really devote myself to making sure all of my tables are always clean, making sure that everybody I'm on time with everything. Not only did I start making more money, but I also like work wasn't as difficult because I was convincing myself to believe in it. Now, ultimately, I was still believing in something empty and hollow. I was believing in a company that at the end of the day was nothing. They didn't have my back. It didn't matter. But I kind of saw why people will sell out and choose to believe. And maybe that's what it is for Cyril Karn, is it's like he's making a choice that if I'm going to have a shot at being successful at all under this regime, I have to choose to believe in it. And I think sometimes we can see that across the political spectrum in America, that there are people who just are like, I'm going to choose to be patriotic and to believe in America, whatever the fuck that means, because it's easier than not believing in it. I feel like I'll have a better shot at competing here in this country and doing better and paying my rent. And maybe just my day-to-day life will be a little bit psychologically and emotionally easier if I choose to believe in this. The ultimate risk, I think, with belief is that we risk having our hearts broken. Not just in love, but if you choose to sell out on a belief to a company, and then that company one day just comes and says, we no longer have room for you here. We have to make, you know, we have to get rid of redundancies, and we don't have a spot for you here on the payroll, and you need to go. It's heartbreaking, right? When you really convinced yourself, I have family here, I have community here, and I'm putting in the amount of effort I am because I believe in the cause of this company, I believe in this company's goals, and then you're just cut loose. And this happens in relationships, and sometimes this happens in religion, where you're really sold in and bought into a religion, and you really believe that this community, this religion has your back, until it doesn't. And that's the ultimate risk, right, is that like these beliefs can break our hearts and break us kind of psychologically and devastate us emotionally when we dare to buy into them. And I don't know, I think for a guy like Cyril Karn, maybe it's just that the empire has not yet sufficiently broken his heart. He still remains devoted to his belief. You know, I think that there are people in regimes too. Like the Dominion case at Fox News showed this. I think that there are in that same vein of people who adhere to the empire because they want to be close to power. They don't really care if it's right or wrong. I think that in our dynamic, capitalistically, we are surrounded by people like that too. We're surrounded by people who are just like, I will say whatever I need to say politically to make the most money and to get the biggest bag. Whatever I think I can do best with and materially, I will do that. And we see that all the time. And I think that the Dominion case at Fox News was one of our best modern examples of that, right? Where we had like text quotes coming out of Tucker Carlson texting with his producer. And his producer said, this is a direct quote. The day after January 6th, Tucker Carlson's producer texted him and said, they take the president literally. He is to blame for everything that happened today. They had a whole back and forth. And then Tucker Carlson responded to his producer, he's a demonic force, a destroyer, but he's not going to destroy us. I've been thinking about this every day for 4 years. There are so many different quotes that came out in that lawsuit that showed that major personalities at Fox News, major conservative talking heads and conservative propagandists don't actually believe in the cause of the totalitarian regime, don't actually believe in Trumpism and the cult of Trumpism. It's just been good for their bottom lines. And they're also like too high to get it. They're too high up to get into any other line of work. But it's so crazy to see that behind the scenes, they actually don't believe in the cause. They're just there because they are soulless and they don't actually believe in anything anymore. So I go back to the title of the show, like, why are believers the easiest demographic to convert? Well, at the top level, the people who are not true believers, the people who are just sold out because they have nowhere else to go, you're not going to convert them because they know they're painted into a corner. Whether they're the soulless types like Tucker Carlson, who is just like, hey, this is where I get my bag, and I'm not going to get my bag anywhere else. Like, Ben Shapiro knows, Matt Walsh knows, there's no other place for them to get paid ever again for the rest of their lives. There's nothing else they can do but be propagandists for this totalitarian regime. There is no other viable career option for them. They're stuck. Whether they believe in it or not is irrelevant. So what they do is they decide to not really believe in anything. They just believe in their bottom line and taking care of them and theirs, making sure that their kids have a nice, hearty inheritance. Those people can't be reached because they have no values. They have no actual ideals that can be appealed to. And then when we go down to the lower levels, when we go down to our just like ignoramuses and idiots and dipshits, it's hard to appeal to those people, right? Because in order to convert them, you need to be able to educate them. You need people who are actually able to process complex and new information. People who are able to, who have well enough developed critical thinking skills that they can see the irrationality and the illogical nature of their current position. The problem is they have the position they currently have because of their inability to think critically, because of their inability to adequately process new information. So those people wind up kind of being largely a lost cause. They kind of wind up being a group of people that's really hard to convert because they're just kind of dumb and they're just dug in on like Jesus and the Bible and Trump and guns, guns and Trump and Bible and Jesus and dirt road pickup truck. Like a person like that's going to watch a show like Andor and it's all gonna fly a mile over their head. Like, and they might watch it and go like, I like the part when the spaceship went pew. I like it when the spaceship has lightsabers that come out of it. I like that part of the show. And you're just like, you're not going to be able to convert the Idiocracy to the Resistance. You're not going to be able to turn Dax Shepard from the movie Idiocracy into a meaningful, useful resistance fighter. So the only people you're really left with is the true believers. Why is a Cyril Karn or a person like Cyril Karn, why did they choose to believe in something like this? And you could say that it is, well, the Empire is the most powerful thing in the galaxy, so it makes sense to believe in the most powerful thing. And sometimes you can see that with like American Christians, right? That they're just like, well, Christianity has dominated the globe. If I'm going to pick a religion, why wouldn't I pick the biggest one? And so why would I not be part of the top dogs? But also sometimes you see people sell out on cults where it's like, that makes no sense. Why would you be a part of the cult at Sarah Lawrence? If you haven't ever watched that documentary, it's crazy. But I've talked about this on other episodes. You know, the cult at Sarah Lawrence, Nexium, the cult of Mother God. Like, you look at how life is for these people, where they're losing their family members, their friends, where the people who were in the cult of Mother God were all like, they were living like 30 people to one house, you know, five people to a room, and they were all serving Mother God and living in like squalid conditions, you know, completely abandoning their friends and family, totally emotionally and psychologically isolating themselves. And it seems like terrible conditions for them. And it doesn't really make any sense, but I think that is kind of the double-edged sword of belief, is because that's what can make it difficult, right? Is it's like they've chosen to believe in something. They've chosen to give their life meaning by believing in this person, even though this person is abusive to them. I think we see that in love too, right? You see people from the outside who are in an abusive relationship with someone and you go, why are you selling out on this belief? This person is not good for you. This person is regularly hurting you. And a belief can be a hard thing to break. The reason why I still believe that true believers are the only ones or the most likely ones to be converted is because a belief can be broken. And in order to break a belief, you just need to be willing to break a believer's heart. So somehow, some way, before it gets so bad, before the abusive partner actually kills them, before the cult kills them, before they become, you know, too far psychologically gone to be reached, you need to find a way to be able to, I don't know that this can be done by any one individual person, but I will say that in my personal experience of watching people be converted from one belief set or one ideology to another, it always is because they were somehow disillusioned. Their heart was somehow broken by that belief system, and they were willing to accept other options and open themselves up to the pain of the heartbreak. And that's what it was in my personal case. I was a true believer. I was a true believing member of the LDS faith. I was raised in the Mormon church in Sandy, Utah. And I had to be willing to have my heart broken by the realization that I don't actually think that religion is based in any kind of empirical evidential truth, that I don't actually think that Joseph Smith talked to God and Jesus in his backyard when he was a boy. I think he made that up. And I think that a lot of people bought into the idea because they chose to throw their lot in with that belief for whatever reason at the time. Again, that was a religion where, like, early on, it was hard for people to be believers in it. They had to sacrifice a lot to believe in it. So it's a tough thing to kind of wrap your brain around. But when I was growing up, it was easy to be a believer in it. It was the most powerful culture in the area that I lived in. It was the culture that was the domineering power structure of the world that I lived in. All of my neighbors were Mormon. All of my friends were Mormon. Why would I not be Mormon? It would be significantly harder for me to not be Mormon. It was the easier move. What was hard was being willing to break my own heart, kind of, and step away from it and reform myself into something else. And so far to this day, I have witnessed so many different people come to me over the years, people I went to high school with, people in my family, close friends who have come to me and who have experienced the same kind of psychic shift that I experienced, the same ideological shift that I experienced. And all of them, without exception, were true believers. They were people who were really, really dug in, who had a really strong faith in this ideology and who had experienced some kind of process of uncoupling from it, some kind of heartbreaking, psychologically difficult, emotionally difficult process of uncoupling from that thing. It's very rare to meet a person who is just sort of casually going along, who had never been very thoughtful about their faith, who was just sort of like, yeah, I was just sort of doing it because it's just what everyone was doing, who then uncouples from it. Because even when I do meet those people, again, they're not going to be good resistance fighters. They're not going to be good people to like recruit to the cause because they're just as unthoughtful about their uncoupling as they were about their faith. When they do uncouple from it, I see stuff all the time where people are just sort of like, oh, I just kind of wanted to drink. Like I'll see like Mormon people or, you know, because LDS people don't drink, they don't do drugs. And it seems like they'll just kind of be like, oh, I still believe absolutely 100% in the church. I just wanted to drink. Like I just kind of like, I drink alcohol now and I smoke weed sometimes. It's like, cool. So your uncoupling from the faith structure wasn't so much this like massive psychological shift that involved like a real introspective process of critical thought. It was just sort of like, I want to be able to have sex outside of marriage and I want to be able to drink alcohol and smoke weed, which like, hey, I get it. Totally fine. But that person's not going to be the kind of person who you're going to be able to like have a really thoughtful conversation with about, you know, political radicalization and like, you know, pushing back against a totalitarian political regime. That's just a person who like their faith was always very surface level and very skin deep and their faith transition is very skin deep. They're just sort of like, I just wanted to do things that the church said I couldn't do. But a lot of those people will still be like, oh, I still fully believe that like angels visited 14-year-old Joseph Smith. I just think that it's fine if I drink alcohol, you know? And it's like, okay, sure, whatever. You know, I think you should think more about that, but whatever. The reason why a true believer, again, is going to be a good target is because true believers tend to be deeper thinkers about their belief. They actually have thought more about the justification and the rationale for their worldview. And that's why it can be also hard to reach them because they're really dug in, but there's something more personal and like spiritual and emotional tying them to that. A Cyril Karn type, that guy has a fully formed rationale about his worldview, that if you were able to sit him down and say, explain to me why you believe in the empire, he'd be able to do it in a way that was maybe kind of poetic and beautiful and well thought out. It would not be surface level. It would be deep for him. He has a deep emotional and spiritual tie to the empire. It's the reason why he falls in love with his love interest on the show, who is another excellent villain on the show named Deidre Miro, who's kind of like, she's this imperial officer who he meets, who she has the same kind of love and devotion to the empire that he has. He sees all these other people who are just opportunists, who are ladder climbers, who are just trying to make money or whatever, and he doesn't feel a kinship to them because they don't believe in the cause the way that he does. And I remember this. When I was LDS, I felt like I was surrounded by people who weren't paying attention the way I was. Like, they didn't actually really care about it the way I did. They showed up and they went through the motions. They went to church. They paid their tithing. They did all the things you're supposed to do to have a temple recommend and to be like in good standing with the church. But I didn't think any of them were as like, not none of them, but most of the people I surrounded myself with didn't seem as thoughtful about their faith or their beliefs as I was about mine. We have this thing in the LDS church that was one of my favorite things growing up, which is that members of the community are called on to speak in church. So a lot of churches will just have like a pastor or a priest or a preacher give the homily at Sunday worship service, right? Like the person who's in charge of that church, the lead pastor, the lead voice, it's their job to be a professional speaker. That definitely has its benefits to it because sometimes like it can be hard to go to an LDS church service and you're just watching random members of the community lead the church service and they just don't really seem to put a lot of effort into it. So you're watching people who aren't very good at public speaking try their hand at public speaking, and it's kind of boring and hard to listen to and kind of boilerplate and surface level and not very interesting or thought provoking. And it can be better to go to a church where the preacher's like a professional, where the preacher knows how to put on a show, where the preacher knows how to tell a story, and where the preacher knows how to get you by the guts. But I loved growing up being a performer, being a person who obviously loves yapping. I loved that my church afforded me the opportunity to get up in front of my community and express to them my thoughts on our shared faith structure. But that's because like I think it's actually such a cool opportunity to invite members of the community to conduct Sunday service. And I think it's an opportunity that most of the people who are members of the faith that I grew up in didn't take advantage of. So I feel this, I felt like sort of like a Cyril Karn, where like I was a true believer in the cause. I thought it was amazing that I get an opportunity to stand up in front of my community and explain to them why this church means so much to me, why this religion means so much to me. I feel like Cyril Karn's the same way. He sees like this beauty, this immense beauty in the empire. He sees this purpose and this cause that's very deep and personal to him, but he feels like he's surrounded by a bunch of people who are just sort of doing it because that's what you do. They're just sort of going through the motions. Like, why would I resist doing this? The empire is everything. They're the most powerful force in the galaxy. Why would I do anything other than this? And that's what I felt like I was surrounded by. And that's ultimately what kind of began my disillusionment and what began my process of like uncoupling and breaking my own heart and breaking away from this faith structure. And again, when I meet people throughout my life, I've been out of this church for almost 20 years now. And again, friends, family members, people, you know, just acquaintances from high school, people have come to me and let me know about their faith transitions. There's an entire podcast called Mormon Stories run by a guy named John DeLynn. I did an episode on it once. It's a 7-hour long conversation about my faith transition that is full of these stories of people who are true believing members who went through a faith transition, explaining their faith transition. And it's always this like really interesting, nuanced, complex process. And every time people come to me to let me know about their faith transition, it's always like the deep thinkers, like the people who really, really thought about their faith and who really thought about why it was that they believed the things that they believed in. And that's why I actually think that the Cyril Karn types, those types, the Austin Archer types, are the most reachable types. That when it comes to the Trump cult, you're not going to be able to convince the soulless opportunists who are just in it for money or who are so high up in the ranks that they're too afraid to get out. You're never going to be able to get those people. They are stuck. And you're most likely not going to be able to really get the people who just sort of do it because they're not very thoughtful, because it's just sort of how they just go through life. They just sort of doop-da-doo, you know, stroll through life and don't really think about things. Those people might uncouple from it on their own, but it won't be a very like deep, thoughtful process. So you're not going to be able to recruit them into some kind of radical opposition resistance movement. The people who are going to be the best targets for this are the people who actually really believe in the cause of conservative politics, who really believe that conservative policies are better. They really believed in the the values and the principles of conservative ideology, and they've seen that ideology taken over by a radical, authoritarian, fascist, totalitarian, dark ideology. A lot of them are terrified to speak up about it, but it's those people who are going to be our most valuable assets in the resistance to this totalitarian takeover. It is the people whose hearts are being broken by this ideology who are going to be our most valuable resistance fighters, because there's nothing like a person who can say, I know intimately what it's like to believe in that thing. I know it because I lived it. I'm incapable of strawmanning these people or overlooking them or you know, kind of talking around their policies, because I actually intimately know them. I know most of them better than they do. Let's hear what the TikTok digital studio audience thinks about it. They've been having a lively discussion over here while I've been yapping. What do y'all think? TikTok digital studio audience. Nainani says, it's complicated, but I was isolated from all my friends and family on the premise that they were racist. You can be isolated from friends and family for having a faith transition too. I definitely was. When I first left the LDS faith, it was probably 5 years where it was really, really hard. People ask me all the time, was that difficult? And I go, oh yeah, it's one of the hardest things I've ever done. By the way, I'm sober. I got sober 7 years ago, and I think leaving the church was harder than getting sober. Getting sober was mostly just like upside. Like, everyone in my life was just stoked for me. There was no one in my life that was like mad at me for getting sober. When I told everyone that I was trying to get sober, people would just go, good for you. Oh, wow. I'm so proud of you. When I was leaving the church, everyone in my community, my friends and family members, were literally all like, so disappointed in me, so profoundly, like, people would literally say, like, what happened, man? What happened to you? What is going on? My close friends would be like, help me understand this. Why are you doing this? It felt to them like I was doing something to them. Like I was actively hurting them. I still have people in my life who still feel that way, that I'm doing this to them, that my transition away from the faith that I was raised in is like, it's an offense to them. And it's still difficult, but it took about 5 years before people in my life slowly started to come around. And more over the last 20 years, more and more friends, more and more family members have come around. And now it's like, I have more people in my life from that part of my life who understand my side and who are cool with my side and who actually agree with my side than I did before. It's a reason why I actually believe that people can be reached in the first place. It's the reason why I don't just go, it's a lost cause. Like people who are part of the Trump cult, it's a lost cause. I've seen people who are dug in on harmful beliefs come around. I've seen it again and again and again. I've seen it myself, and I've seen it in lots of people in my life. I've seen it in people in my audience. I've seen it happen time and time again. It can happen. Tiger Wood asks, did you leave because you don't believe the tenets of the religion? Correct. My faith was never surface level. It was never skin deep. My faith was a very deep personal thing that I was always very thoughtful about. I was always really thoughtful about like the mind and the intention of God. Like the LDS Church posits a very specific plan to its memberships, to its membership about how the universe was made, why it was made, why the earth was made, what the point of coming to earth and gaining a physical body is, what the goal is in the afterlife. And I thought a lot about all of that stuff. I thought about like the logic of the story that was being told to me, and I really worked hard on making puzzle pieces fit that didn't quite fit. Because early on, I could always see kind of like plot holes in the story, right? But I would do the work to be like, I'm going to figure out why God would potentially do it that way. Or I would, you know, ask sincerely in prayer to understand certain things. Or I would bring those things to my teachers and my, you know, seminary teachers and leaders. And I was always, rather than just like showing up and going to church because it's what my parents wanted me to do and it's what the adults in my neighborhood wanted to do, I wanted to know that I had a personal connection to it. That if somebody asked me, why do you do this? I wouldn't just go, I don't know. It's just what I was told to do. I wanted to know that I could be able to have an articulate answer that would be effective. And it was that kind of relationship to my faith that ultimately led to me no longer believing in it, because I just was a person who couldn't stop tugging on sweater threads. I was a person who, like, I needed to be able to critically approach my belief system from all different angles. And I got to a certain age where I realized that I'd been actively shielding myself from a whole subset of questions and, like, you know, critical analysis of my faith, because the faith structure actively tells you as you're growing up to not pay attention to certain books, certain questions, certain people, certain kinds of, like, certain lines of inquiry. And so I didn't, you know, there were just certain things that I would go, that's bad for me. If I listen to that, or if I entertain that question, it's bad for my faith, so I just won't do that. Sometimes they call it, you know, putting it on a shelf. They'll just tell their membership, like, just take that, put it on a shelf. But because I am the kind of guy I am, and I want to make sure I can say, no, I've examined this from every possible angle. I'm positive that this is what I believe in, and I know exactly why I believe in it. I got to a certain age where I started taking that stuff down from the shelf, and I honestly had faith that my belief was strong enough that it would be able to withstand the scrutiny that I was going to expose it to from all of these questions that I'd been actively avoiding. And spoiler alert, my faith was not strong enough to withstand that scrutiny. It actually fell apart pretty quickly. Once I was able to just sort of entertain certain lines of thought and lines of inquiry and lines of critical analysis, it all just unraveled pretty quickly, which is why today, 20 years out of the religion, when I see people who are still in it, my general assumption is, you know, there's one of a handful of reasons why you're still in it. A, you're just not very thoughtful about what it is that you believe. You just do it because it works for you and your family, and that's what's worked your whole life. And you know that being overly thoughtful about it is kind of dangerous for your relationship to it, and you want to preserve the relationship, so you just don't really ask certain questions. Or B, you've reached a certain level of power and authority in that structure where you're too high up to get out. And so you're either afraid of investigating, or you're maybe a little bit soulless and power hungry and a little bit opportunistic. Or there's the third option where somehow, against the odds, you've remained a true believing member who has a deep, thoughtful connection to it. And those are the people who I actually think, who I'm talking about in this episode of the podcast, who I actually think are the people who are the most likely to eventually come around. I think that those kind of people who have a very thoughtful, you know, testimony and relationship to their faith, I think those are the kind of people who almost always come around to a more rational worldview. We're going to wrap things up here. Hey, you on YouTube, if you want a full version of this podcast where I do the full talk back with the audience, I know that you saw some of the questions in the talk back in this video, but you didn't see all of them. There's even more. There's an extended version over on Patreon. Patreon gets early postings. This podcast gets posted early on Patreon, and the full unedited version gets posted over there. So if you want early content, bonus content, or if you just want to support this show, go on over to patreon.com/AustinArcher to support this show, because that's also another thing that every good resistance needs, right? We need fucking funding. I'm telling you, I went and did a big event in Pennsylvania during the election with this political activist company, and they were asking us, what's the best way that we can support you as creators? And I was like, give us money, give us more money. Because I do get paid by these political activist companies from time to time to do stuff. But, like, when you see how well-funded the totalitarian regime is, when you see how well-funded conservative social media is, they're killing us with money. So if you want to support the resistance, support your favorite resistance creators, you know? So a great way to do that, patreon.com/AustinArcher. Support the show, support the resistance. Shout out to all the Patreon patrons. Love you so much for your support. Truly could not do this without you. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, all linked in the description of this video. Check out the Wonder Podcast. That's my other podcast where we talk about movies. I'll be doing a more thorough breakdown of Andor Season 1 over on the Wonder Podcast this week. Check that out. Again, linked in the description. Okay, that's it. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. Love you so much, and bye. Bye-bye.